You're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. In this episode, we launch into our exploration of linguistics in America by looking at some of the key contributions of Franz Boas. In the patriarchy-affirming mode of much intellectual history, Boas is often referred to as the founding father of American anthropology. But Boas was in fact a German import. He was born and raised in the Prussian province of Westphalia and received his entire education in Germany. But it was in the United States that Boas made his academic career, and it was his work and the work of his students that brought about a paradigm shift in American anthropology. This is part of the story of American linguistics, because linguistics was one of the four fields of anthropology as it was conceived by Boas, alongside ethnography, that is, the recording of cultures, archaeology, the investigation of material remains, and physical anthropology, the measuring and comparison of people's bodies. It's fair to say that it was with Boas and the Boasians that a peculiarly American tradition of linguistics first started to emerge. Linguistics had, of course, been practiced in America before Boas's arrival. We might recall in particular the work of William Dwight Whitney, who we met all the way back in episode 8. As we discussed in that episode, Whitney's American background gave him a unique perspective on the study of language. But Whitney's gaze was still directed towards Europe. His main scholarly models and interlocutors were all on that continent. Paradoxically, it's only with the advent of Boas, a European by birth and education, that a characteristically American anthropology and linguistics began to take shape. It's no accident that this new American linguistics was tied to anthropology. Back in episode 19, we saw how British linguistics was also intertwined with ethnography, much more so than in other European countries. This was in no small part due to the existence of the British Empire. A great deal of institutional support for language study in Britain was directed towards facilitating communication and control of the peoples colonized by the British around the world. In similar fashion, the settler colonial state, that is the United States, provided resources for research into the languages and cultures of the indigenous inhabitants of the lands on which it was built. Boasian linguistics, as part of a broader anthropological project, was concerned with the documentation, description, and classification of indigenous languages, primarily in North America, but his school also went on to study languages in other parts of the world. Before we turn to the details of Boasian linguistics, let's just take a moment to consider the nature of Boas's school. When Boas settled in America in 1887, the field of anthropology only had minimal institutional recognition. In 1886, a professorship in American linguistics and archaeology had been created at the University of Philadelphia, which was held by Daniel Garrison Brinton. Here's a figure we'll meet again in a moment. But there were no training programs in anthropology. Brinton himself had actually trained and earlier worked as a physician and was self-taught in anthropology. The main institution supporting anthropological research in the United States at this time was the Bureau of Ethnology, an independent research unit funded by the U.S. federal government and affiliated with the Smithsonian Institution. The Bureau had been founded in 1879 by John Wesley Powell, a geologist, explorer, and soldier, that is, an all-round adventurer scholar. The primary duty of the Bureau was to supervise the ethnographic records and collections of the US government, although it also undertook extensive original ethnographic and linguistic survey work under Powell's direction. Some of Boas's early research in the United States was funded by the Bureau. The first graduate program in anthropology in America was that set up by Boas when he was promoted to professor at Columbia University in New York in 1899. This program helped to professionalize the field and produced a number of leading scholars that had an incomparable impact on the further development of anthropology, and many of whom became prominent public intellectuals. A few names we should mention include Edward Sapir, who was a major figure in American linguistics in the next generation. A coming podcast episode will be devoted to Sapir and his student Benjamin Lee Whorf. We should mention also Ruth Benedict, who, after completing her studies with Boas in 1923, stayed on and became a professor in Boas's department at Columbia. Benedict is a prime example of the anthropologist as public intellectual, as can be seen in her 1946 book, The Chrysanthemum and the Sword. The book is an ethnography of Japan made during World War II, with the express purpose of suggesting how Japanese society can be reconstructed after the war to create a cooperative partner for America in the future. But the brightest star in the Boasian heaven would have to be Margaret Mead, who completed her doctorate under the joint supervision of Boas and Benedict. Mead's first book, the 1928 Coming of Age in Samoa, was an immediate bestseller. The controversial and sensational claim of her book was that Samoan teenagers enjoyed much freer love lives than their Western counterparts. As a result, argued Mead, Samoan teenagers did not suffer from the repressed sexuality and associated neuroses that plagued Western youth. This book was the beginning of Mead's long career as a social commentator. A novelty of Boas's school was that it included people from the communities that were studied. That is, people who work in both the roles of anthropologist and informant. Here we should mention Ella Cara Deloria, who came from a Dakota background. She was drawn into Boas's circle while studying at Columbia Teachers College, and went on to study with Boas and complete a number of projects under his direction. The 1932 Dakota Texts is a collection of Dakota tales recorded by Deloria. And the 1941 Dakota Grammar was co-authored by Deloria and Boas. Another important figure is Zora Neale Hurston, who was African-American. She first encountered the Boasians while studying at Barnard College. That's the undergraduate women's college that was associated with Columbia University. And she continued graduate study with Boas, Benedict, and Mead at Columbia. Her 1935 book, Mules and Men, is a collection of folklore from the African-American communities she grew up in, which she retold in literary form. We should note, too, that Boas and Sapir were from Jewish families. In both the German and American contexts, then as now, this is a minority background. So from our present-day perspective, one of the most striking things about Boas's school is that it was not made up solely of upper-middle-class white males, who have been the vast majority of figures we've spoken about so far in this podcast. We're beginning to see for the first time the academic space open up to new groups of people. This opening up is partly a function of the era, the new 20th century, and in particular the roaring 20s of that century. But even in this environment, Boas's circle was considered particularly progressive, both in terms of its composition and in the views it entertained. Let's now examine the substance of Boas's anthropology. In order to understand why his approach was considered so revolutionary, we have to first look at the ideas underlying American anthropology when Boas arrived on that continent. American anthropology at this time was based around an evolutionist conception of human society and culture. John Wesley Powell, the founder and head of the Bureau of Ethnology, endorsed the evolutionary theories of Lewis Henry Morgan, another of these 19th century American amateur anthropologists. Morgan believed in a deterministic scheme of social evolution. He assumed that there are distinct stages in social and cultural development through which each people must pass. In his 1877 book, Ancient Society, he identified the primary evolutionary stages of savagery, barbarism, and finally civilization. The highest levels of civilization, according to Morgan, had been reached by 19th century European man, while the indigenous inhabitants of America were still stuck in the earlier stages of savagery and barbarism. In Morgan's scheme, the chief determinant of a people's stage of social evolution is technology, and each of the stages of evolution is supposed to correlate with different social structures, architectural styles, and even structures of language. In Germany, Boas had been inducted into a rather different tradition. The single most important personal connection shaping Boas's anthropological outlook would have to be Adolf Bastian, a Berlin anthropologist and director of the Berlin Museum für Völkerkunde, that is, the Museum for Ethnology. Boas worked for Bastian in the museum while he was completing his habilitation in Berlin. Bastian was known above all as an advocate of what is commonly termed the psychic unity of mankind. This is the principle that all humans, no matter what their ancestry or where they live, share in a single common humanity. Bastian argued that the mental world of every people consists at base of the same Elementargedanken, or elementary thoughts, but that these elementary thoughts are then arranged in different ways to produce the Völkergedanken, or ethnic thoughts, of specific peoples. The task of anthropology, according to Bastian, is to record as much as possible of the diversity of human culture, of the different Völkergedanken, in order to build up a picture of the unity of humanity. Bastian was highly critical of contemporary approaches to anthropology that sought to discover universal laws of human culture, as was the case with the accounts of cultural evolution popular in America. It may one day be possible to find such universal laws, conceded Bastian, but all present theories lack a sufficient empirical basis and are at the very least premature. As we've seen in the previous podcast episodes, this tension between trying to discover universal laws and studying the particular historical development of individuals was a recurring motif in the human sciences in the 19th century, especially in the German-speaking countries. But as Matti Bunzel demonstrated in his 1996 essay, Franz Boas and the Humboldtian Tradition, Boas and Bastian both received particular inspiration from the work of the brothers Wilhelm and Alexander von Humboldt. Wilhelm von Humboldt we've of course met at a few places already in this podcast, perhaps most notably in episodes 3 and 4. Wilhelm focused on the study of the human world, above all on language and history, while his brother Alexander devoted his attention mostly to the natural world. As part of his researches, Alexander undertook several exploring expeditions, most famously in South America from 1799 to 1804. On his exploring expeditions, Alexander made detailed investigations of the natural environment, but also of the societies, cultures, and languages of the people who lived there. In his writings, Boas cited a long line of his German predecessors, including both the Humboldt brothers. And in his 1996 essay, Matti Bunzel points out that Bastian's Völkergedanken, with their combination of underlying mental unity and surface diversity, represented the same kind of idea as the notion of Volksgeist, as it was promulgated in Steinthal and Lazarus's Völkerpsychologie, as well as the notion of Nationalcharakter, as described by Wilhelm von Humboldt. Steinthal and Lazarus's Völkerpsychologie, of course, also owed a great deal to the work of Wilhelm von Humboldt, as we discussed back in episode 6. In the second half of the 19th century, Steinthal was widely acknowledged as the chief interpreter of Humboldt. The tension between discovering universal laws and studying individuals was explicitly articulated in Boas's work as well. However, over the course of his career, Boas accorded increasingly greater importance to the study of individual peoples and their cultures. One of the most tangible manifestations of the clash between these two competing conceptions were the debates about the arrangement of artifacts in museums, in which Boas became embroiled in America. Adolf Bastian had arranged the Berlin Ethnological Museum according to geographical regions, or geographical provinces, as he put it. Bastian's aim was to quite literally showcase the individuality of each ethnic group in its geographical context. But the curator of the ethnographic collections of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., a certain Otis T. Mason, grouped artifacts together along the lines of what they were used for, Within these primary groupings, he then put the items in sequence of the putative evolutionary stage that they represented. In 1887, shortly after arriving in America, Boas decried this approach to the arrangement of the Smithsonian Institution's collections in a letter to the journal Science. There, Boas argued that we have to study each ethnological specimen individually in its history and in its medium, and this is the important meaning of the geographical province, which is so frequently emphasized by A. Bastian. By regarding a single implement outside of its surroundings, outside of other phenomena affecting that people and its productions, we cannot understand its meaning. Boas's critique was not favorably received. In a reply in Science, Mason rejected Boas's arguments. And John Wesley Powell, the head of the Bureau of Ethnology, jumped to Mason's side in support. In his own reply in Science, Powell made a number of counterarguments to Boas, on both theoretical and practical grounds. Powell's central contention was that there can be no single correct systematization of a museum exhibition, but the arrangement by geographical province that Boas suggested was completely unworkable. For one thing, ethnic groups vary over time and shade into one another. The fluidity of ethnic identity is particularly characteristic of the Americas, and this fluidity has been made even more extreme through the disruption resulting from European colonization. Somewhat surprisingly, given the arguments that we've seen so far, Powell concluded that the unity of mankind is the greatest induction of anthropology. The implication being that the arrangement of the Smithsonian collections made by Mason is preferable because it attempts to tell a coherent story about the commonalities between different human groups, namely by fitting them into an evolutionary narrative. The approach proposed by Boas, on the other hand, offers no big picture. It merely presents an unordered selection of materials. And the classification by ethnic group that Boas proposes is completely arbitrary anyway, in light of the fluidity of ethnic identity. In his rejoinder to Powell, Boas insisted that his approach would exhibit the individual phenomenon, while Mason's system makes classifications that are not founded on the phenomenon, but in the mind of the student. Just a few years later, Boas had the opportunity to put his ideas into practice, when he was invited by Frederick Putnam to assist in the curation of an ethnological exhibit for the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago, officially known as the World's Columbian Exposition, which was organized to commemorate the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's discovery of America. Putnam was the curator of the Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology, affiliated with Harvard University. But there was a second ethnological exhibition at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, organized by Washington anthropologists, among them Mason and Powell. Visitors to the World's Fair therefore had the opportunity to see both approaches to the organization of ethnological collections, the arrangement according to geographical provinces that Boas adopted from Bastian, and the functional evolutionary approach of Mason. This same tension between deterministic evolutionary views and an individualizing attitude played out in the study of American languages. Let's zoom in and examine one episode that demonstrates this, also from shortly after Boas's arrival in America. In 1889, Boas published an article in the journal American Anthropologist with the title On Alternating Sounds. The alternating sounds that Boas was referring to were the apparent varying pronunciations of words that many anthropologists claimed were characteristic of American languages, and which were often cited as a sign of the alleged primitiveness of American languages. From the perspective of present-day phonological theory, these so-called alternating sounds are the result of several different phenomena. On the one hand, there was genuine free variation in the pronunciation of words in American languages, as there are in all languages. But more interestingly, these alternating sounds were often cases of allophonic variation, a concept that we discussed back in episode 15, or simply sounds that are not found in the languages that most European observers were familiar with. So these alternating sounds were not a peculiarity of American languages, but rather just the products of normal processes of phonological variation, as found in all languages of the world. They only appeared to be unstable and fluctuating because the specific sounds and patterns of variation were unfamiliar to European observers. What was in fact happening is that there was a clash between the native phonological systems of the Europeans and those of the American languages they were trying to record. There were many anthropologists who talked about alternating sounds under one name or another, but the two figures Boas was targeting in his paper were Daniel Garrison Brinton and John Wesley Powell. In 1888, the year before Boas published his paper on alternating sounds, Brinton gave an address at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia on the language of Paleolithic man. This was subsequently published in 1890 under the title The Earliest Form of Human Speech as Revealed by American Tongues. As is immediately clear from the titles, Brinton used his paper to reaffirm evolutionist ideas about American languages. Brinton talked mostly about the lexical and grammatical features of American languages, but he began with a discussion of their phonological features. According to Brinton, so-called primitive speech has not yet attained the levels of arbitrariness and fixedness that characterize the more developed languages. In European languages, individual sounds carry no sense, words have fixed sound forms, and the articulated word alone is enough to convey its meaning. American languages, by contrast, allegedly frequently attach meaning to individual phonetic segments, and word meaning is often modified by devices that cannot be reduced to graphic writing, such as tone, accent, stress, vocal inflection, quantity, and pause. Most importantly, sounds in words can vary freely. The sounds in many American languages, according to Brinton, are singularly vague and fluctuating. Powell discussed this same phenomenon under the name of synthetic sounds. In his Introduction to the Study of Indian Languages, he wrote about the indefinite character of some of the sounds of American languages. Unlike Brinton, however, Powell didn't attribute this to chaotic variation, but rather he believed that these synthetic sounds were complex articulations. European languages, Powell argued, have become more refined over time and so contain only simple sounds. But American languages retain complex articulations. The European observer, unaccustomed to these, will hear the simpler sounds out of which these synthetic sounds are made, and on different occasions they will hear different component sounds. Powell's Introduction to the Study of Indian Languages served as a kind of manual of language description for projects sponsored by his Bureau of Ethnology, and as such had a widespread influence on how European anthropologists conceived of American languages. In response to these views, Boas argued that these alleged alternating or synthetic sounds were not a peculiarity of primitive languages at all, but rather the result of perceptual error on the part of the language researcher. All languages, European and American alike, make use of a fixed and finite repertoire of the total range of sounds that can be produced by the human articulatory organs. When an observer encounters a sound in a foreign language that is not present in their native repertoire, they will apperceive it as a similar sound that is in their repertoire. According to Boas, the mapping from foreign to native sound may vary from occasion to occasion, creating the illusion of alternating sounds. Boas summed up his argument with the following words. "I think, from this evidence, it is clear that all such misspellings are due to a wrong apperception, which is due to the phonetic system of our native language. For this reason, I maintain that there is no such phenomenon as synthetic or alternating sounds, and that their occurrence is in no way a sign of primitiveness of the speech in which they are said to occur. That alternating sounds are in reality alternating apperceptions of one and the same sound. A thorough study of all the alleged alternating sounds or synthetic sounds will show that their existence may be explained by alternating apperceptions." Boas was no doubt right to impugn the perception of his colleagues in many cases where they accused American languages of phonetic fluctuation. But it must be acknowledged that the potential for cross-linguistic phonological interference was already well recognized in the literature of the time. The apparent fluctuating nature of Powell's synthetic sounds was due to the perception of the observer, although because Powell believed that the observer was a speaker of a more refined language who was confronted with a more primitive language. So Boas's paper is rightly celebrated for centering American languages and relativizing the authority of European observers. The supposed signs of primitiveness in American languages are illusions caused by the perceptual limitations and prejudices of linguists and anthropologists. We've characterized the individualizing and relativizing attitude evinced by Boas as part of his Humboldtian heritage. But in the interests of full disclosure, we must acknowledge that Wilhelm von Humboldt's writings were sufficiently open to interpretation that they could be taken in different directions. In his day, Daniel Garrison Brinton was in fact considered the most authoritative interpreter of Wilhelm von Humboldt in America. But Brinton's reading of Humboldt led him to very different conclusions from those entertained by Boas and the majority of the other Germans who took inspiration from Humboldt. The chief monument to Boasian linguistics would have to be the Handbook of American Indian Languages, a compendium surveying the languages of North America, which was published in four volumes from 1911 to 1941. Each volume contains sketch grammars of American languages, accompanied by sample texts. These grammars were written to Boas's specifications, many by Boas himself, and others by his students and affiliates. The handbook was commissioned by the Bureau of Ethnology and was intended to supersede Powell's earlier Introduction to the Study of Indian Languages. The first volume of the handbook contains a long introduction written by Boas that sets out his views on language description and the goals of the handbook. Boas's commitment to treating each language as an individual comes out quite clearly in his introduction. Towards the end of the introduction, he writes, "No attempt has been made to compare the forms of the Indian grammars with the grammars of English, Latin, or even among themselves. But in each case, the psychological groupings which are given depend entirely upon the inner form of each language. In other words, the grammar has been treated as though an intelligent Indian was going to develop the forms of his own thoughts by an analysis of his own form of speech." Here we see once again Boas's debt to the Humboldtian tradition in his invocation of inner form. As we discussed back in episode 6, this was a term first used by Humboldt and subsequently filled out and popularized, above all by Steinthal. The notion of inner form is the underlying principle that characterizes each language as an individual. In this episode, we've only scratched the surface of Boasian linguistics and anthropology. Stay tuned in the coming months for new episodes exploring the work of the Boasians and the history of linguistics in America.